Good afternoon. Yeah, it's a pleasure and honor to be here. We have a program, we have a wonderful program in Knot Faction that just started a week ago. The last week was dedicated to smell in insects. And I guess the main conclusion that can be drawn, like if I would summarize it, would be that we're not so different from our smaller cousins, the insects. So the olfactory system is essentially the same. And there are many elements of insect olfactory system that are shared by us mammals and primates. And perhaps it's just basically a scaled down version of the mammalian olfactory system. And perhaps it will be basically the first that will be fully understood. Deconstructing the sense of smell, I just want to break down the question of olfactory perception to several ends. First, of course, there are smells, put on molecules. The second level are the receptors, are the molecules in our body that interact with olfactory molecules and recognize them. Well, they're called receptors. Genes that encode them. It's remarkable that olfactory receptors, they're actually proteins that bind and activated by the odorants. They're very similar in structure to the molecules that are produced by cells in our retina that are responsible for recognition of light and for our color vision. And we all know that there are three types of such molecules in color vision. So color vision has three molecules. Three types of molecules, should I say. There are much more than three molecules. The olfactory system, it was discovered in the early 90s by Linda Buck and Richard Axel that an average mouse olfactory system, an average mammal olfactory system, includes about 1,000 such molecules. With a few exceptions. One of those exceptions is humans. Humans have about 350. So we are certainly inferior, appear to be inferior in that sense. Actually, Darren Lancet, who is one of the participants, there are some anecdotal couplings, and not so anecdotal couplings between color vision and olfactory system. So Darren Lancet published a paper about 10 years ago that related the loss of the olfactory receptors in human to acquisition of three color vision. So it turns out that in monkeys that have they can recognize three colors, the number of receptors is substantially reduced. I think 50% of our loss of olfactory receptors can be attributed to us, to our acquisition of third color.
So another, what is that number for a typical mammal, the color vision number?
I think it's 2 for most mammals. Another anecdotal relationship between color vision, just to get over with color vision, in vision in general, in recognition of color, is that the molecule rhodopsin that interacts with the light actually uses, it's a composite molecule, it contains a ligand that is bound to it called retinol. So to recognize light is that it actually uses something that is produced outside of our body. It's a form of vitamin A. So it looks like color vision to some vision, interaction with light, to some degree mimics the sort of the recognition of molecules. Because it relies on vitamin that we eat in carrots, for example.
So the next level.
I will talk in more detail in a few minutes about olfactory receptors. But
the next level would be neural processing. Which is
how the networks in our brain represent smells and how those smells are processed by the networks.
This is probably
the subject on which this workshop will be focusing the most. Because there's basically a lot of data that you can collect by measuring or recording responses of neurons.
And the last and final step is the perception. And olfactory perception is to a degree elusive because it's very difficult to characterize how we sense smells. It's something that we have inside.
Analog of this, just to give you some idea, would be RGB, right, in color vision again.
Red, green, and blue are perceptual variables,
although we know how they map onto the properties of light. It's still our internal perception of what kind of stimulus we see.
And so the question is, what are the olfactory RGBs, I guess? What is the analog of olfactory RGBs?
The potential, of course, is enormous. It's possible that there are 1,000 or even more those dimensions, those perceptual dimensions that the stimuli of the light provide us. And that would be probably a hopeless task to recognize that. And I'll talk a little bit during my talk. So what are the open questions that I think are interesting? So one of those questions that I wrote there, what are the elements of olfactory perception? How can we describe olfactory perception? The second prominent question is, what are the properties of molecules that correspond to those percepts? Can we predict how the molecules will smell to us just based on the chemical, their chemical structure? Corresponding properties. Finally, there are many open questions, obviously. I would actually emphasize the question that is most interesting to me, is how those receptors, how those thousands of receptors, how the thousands of receptors evolved to facilitate this function. What are the principles that guide the evolution of olfactory receptors? I think one of the sort of images, a simplified version of olfactory system that I want to present, it's basically a retina. We have about 1 million pixels in our retina, and each pixel has three color sensors in them. And Jan, I think, actually was a computer genius. He figured out why you would have a small number. Early in the 19th century, he figured out why would you have three sensors in the eye. And the idea was that because pixels are so small, there is not enough room for you to put too many sensors there, so there must be some limited number. So with olfactory system, the spatial resolution is not so important. So olfactory system is basically a retina with a single pixel with 1,000 colors. So that's basically a very crude approximation of what we're dealing with. Why is it interesting to study olfaction? I think, obviously, not much is understood. I mean, there are basically huge gaps in our knowledge, so that drives enthusiasm. of researchers to pursue this subject. I mean, but olfaction also has a human relevance. Like one of those things is obviously flavor. So it turns out that as you eat, most of the perceptual, substantial part of perception of food is actually smell of food that is delivered to your olfactory epithelium through the back of your mouth. So the perception of food is not only the taste of food, but also the smell of food. You can actually like chew a jelly bean and close your nose and see, and then open your nose and see how this, how the taste of jelly bean will change. Another maybe understudied but very relevant, I think, feature of olfactory system or the significance of olfactory system is in sexual imprinting. So it turns out that imprinting is basically priming of our liking or disliking a person based on their smell. So there are suggestions that avoidance of, for example, of sex between siblings in the same family is based on their exposure to each other, to the smell, to exposure to each other's smell early in their life. For example, people who are raised in kibbutz, in Israeli kibbutzes, they are in the same age group. They are very infrequently that they marry late in life, when they become adolescent. And I mean, although the studies there, they are not conclusively proving that this is due to the sense of smell, and probably there is a substantial amount of cultural component to it, but it is still, it basically shows that there is a potential enormous importance of olfaction to human society. There is one hypothesis that is discussed in amongst researchers is Targaryens, for example, they may have some kind of problems with the olfactory receptors. Yep.
I heard that in certain types of monkeys, color vision is sex-linked, right? That is, the female has it and the male doesn't. Is there a corresponding compensation in the sense of smell?
I mean, I guess the question is whether females have a better sense of smell or not.
Well, I think those that have a different sense of color vision.
I think the reason why females may have an additional color sensor in their eye is because one of the color sensors is on X chromosome. So they have two copies, basically, the same thing, and they're slightly different than you may have. They actually have two different, slightly different spectral sensors, or spectral filters in their eye. I'm not sure about females and olfaction, because olfactory receptors, I mean, the overwhelming amounts of them are everywhere in the genome. And, you know, like most of them are outside the X chromosome, but they only actually have that dimension.
Being on the X chromosome is not necessarily a female-specific receptor, but it doesn't have to be female. It can also be male-specific. So basically, in insects, there are certain receptors that are not present in males, but not in females. Mm-hmm. And so they can sense pheromones, specialized odors from the females, and the females don't need those. That's just one example.
All right, so I will basically switch to the topic of perception, of olfactory perception, simply because I'll just start this pyramid from the back, simply because it just requires virtually no knowledge of biology, so. Yep.
If you talk about something like sex of, you know, wings among siblings or something, does that count as perception, if it's something that, for a human at least, would be totally unconscious? Or is there a different category?
I think that's like unconscious perception.
Unconscious.
I mean, it's semantic. Indeed, I mean, you are actually touching on the right subject, meaning that, I mean, there are a lot of processes that linger in the background and we don't pay conscious attention to them. But they actually influence our lives, you know.
Behavior would be a
thing. Well, that's my question, is whether behavior is sort of a separate thing or by definition is included.
I bundle them together. Although behavior is obviously very important to our experimental theory, because behavior, that's the readout. By talking about animal olfactory system, you know, that's the sort of way of reading percepts. So I want to talk about perception a little bit first. And basically, how do you describe the your perceptions, your how they feel about molecules. And it turns out that with humans, the best way to do it is to ask them to describe the smell in words. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but it turns out that perhaps the most robust way is just to ask people to write a little essay about smells. So because, I mean, you can try to compare smells, like, say, which one is more similar to each other. But those things, they are very subjective, and they don't average out very well. So there are several databases that place odorants in semantic space. And one of them you can actually play around with. It's called flavor map. It's a very nice user interface. It contains about 800 smells. More than 800 smells. And the smells are placed in the space of about 200 words. There is another database that was discovered recently by our colleagues, and it has been studied for the last few years. It's a database which was created by a guy whose name is Andrew Brownings. The main problem with the database, it has been published as a book. It was published in the mid-80s, so you would have to actually scan it and OCR it and then correct for errors. So it's a very difficult process. But it has been made available. And it actually contains vast information about human olfactory perception. And this is how it looks like. Basically, it can be reduced to a table. Where the horizontal corresponds to odorants. And there are about 160 odorants there. Most of them are just molecules. So essentially, you know everything about them. And the vertical is the other words, is the semantic dimension. There are 147 words for some reason.
Are these the words that they were given to choose from, or words that occurred in their, say, whatever word you want?
That's a very good question. So the words were very carefully chosen. Initially, they had, I think, 800 words, but then the researchers chose the words that are the most ambiguous, so people don't cling to a single word. So they're kind of equal in valency. And the words, I mean, the way the responses were actually, the way this database was formed is that people were given an answer sheet where they were presented with 147 words, and then they were asked whether a given word applies to this odorant or not. And the words are like lemon-like. I'm not gonna write all the words. Warm, sharp, cool, sickening. Right? And the database, the table, is filled with percentages. Those are the percentage of the army of observers of 150 people who thought that this word applies to this molecule. So there are percentages range from 1 to 20. Okay. So therefore, each odorant is placed in this 147 dimensional semantic space. This is actually the database. It turns out that to arrive to a stable representation, we need to average over more than 40 people. So this database actually represents the olfaction in its sort of like a communist society, where everybody has the same nose. So the differences between the individuals are averaged out. But I guess in order to understand the olfactory system, perhaps olfaction in the communist society is probably a good start. If we understand that, we can move on, right? So now the question, right? So every odorant is a And study inter-individual differences. So each odorant is a point in the 147 dimensional space. So the question is if you can reduce the dimensionality of this data set and try to see if the actual process, they lie on some kind of manifold that is of smaller dimension. So we used, and many other researchers used, either linear or nonlinear methods. Turns out that the methods that assume that the manifold that you feed to those percepts is curved, they allow it to reduce the dimensionality most efficiently. And I will present you with a two-dimensional representation. Turns out that two-dimensional representation accounts to about 50% of data, about 50% of variance in the data set, the entire 147 dimensions. Yep.
What about wines? There are a lot of words used in there.
Wines were not there. I mean, those were, most of those
single molecules?
Compounds were just single molecules. Right. I think 144 was single molecule, and there were 16 mixtures.
You probably get a lot more volunteers.
Well, if you only get them to smell the wine, then, So the two-dimensional representation, that was just 50% of variance. Looks like this. Well, I mean, those are points, but I'm drawing the surface, and the points are very close to the surface. Actually, Glenn Turner suggested us to call this structure. It's actually curved. It looks like this. He suggested to call it the potato chip. So then what you can look at, what is the meaning of those two dimensions on the potato chip? I mean, the surface exists in 147 dimensions, but it can be parameterized by two parameters. So the vertical dimension is actually the easiest to guess. I'll just write you down the words which I have here. And the idea is that I'll write on top the words which are positively correlated with this elevation, and at the bottom I'll write the words which are negatively correlated.
So here you have aromatic,
rose, cologne. And at the bottom, you have sickening, putrid. It's very telling, right? Rancid. Sweaty. So it's obvious what this dimension represents. It represents how pleasant the molecules are, right? So, I mean, the importance of pleasantness for olfaction has been hypothesized for maybe 100 years, maybe even more. But, this was discovered in this data set by Naum Sobel and by our colleague. There are many studies that follow up on the same idea. They tried to basically refine the definition of this dimension. And it was actually what Naum Sobel did also is he correlated with this dimension that you get from the data analysis with the actual perceived measured pleasantness of an odorant. The second dimension is more elusive. I'll just write you the words, and I'll see if you can find something. Sharp, etherish, chemical, cool. And so those are the negatively correlated. And then the positively correlated are woody, resinous, oily, warm. So it's really difficult really to pinpoint, like to give an anecdotal label to this dimension. So I asked basically a lot of people what would they tell about this dimension. Some people would suggest that this has something to do with kitchen. You know, there's something, if you like to eat wood, I guess. But there are some peanut butter also.
Not Nutella.
So it's interesting, actually, that this dimension, although it's elusive in terms of defining what it means for us, or to give it a single like verbal or semantic label, it's actually quite easy to identify from the properties of the molecules. And it looks like it's correlated with polarity of the molecules, or dipole moment, you know, of ability to hydrophobicity of the molecule. There is one anecdotal also idea that sort of emerged from my discussion with colleagues, is that this dimension may be, this horizontal dimension may be associated with the auditory frequency somehow. So it turns out, well, you can associate auditory frequency sometimes with the molecules. For example, if I ask you what is lower in frequency, oil or vinegar, you would probably, majority of you would probably, if you're not, if you don't get offended by this question, about 10% of people get offended by this question. But you'd probably say that oil is lower in associated auditory frequency than vinegar. And it turns out that the mapping, the coupling between olfaction and auditory system has been discovered more than a century ago by a perfumer in London. His name is Septimus Peace. And then there are some, basically in the 90s, there was some study also to map odorants on the frequency, on the auditory frequency scale. Septimus arranged smells on the piano keys, actually, and he said that he can arrange, he can put any, attribute any odor in his availability to a auditory frequency or to a key or piano. And then, obviously, he was just playing the piano and made it some odor. So that is an interesting and somewhat controversial conclusion from, that you can draw from the horizontal dimension. Yes?
Is each odorant like a point in this surface?
Yes.
Or it's,
so
it's
odorants,
more like a smear?
The odorants are basically both bouncing in and out of the surface. And none of them is on exactly on the surface. This is like a zero measure manifold. But they are basically very close to the surface.
Mm-hmm. Is this very culture dependent? Like, so if you're from a hot place, you don't notice sweaty so much. Like, are these words?
I mean, that's a good question. I wish I had access to this. Again, to get to this database, you need to average over people with over cultural background, unfortunately. So if we had access to like a way to measure this kind of surface for an individual person, that would be wonderful. And I'm sure there would be cultural dependence.
Yeah, but in order to really make this potato chip coordinate work, so this 197 words was location. 147 words
yes.
Are basically defined, right, on the potato chips so that all other odorants can map to a point somewhere on this potato chip.
Yeah.
No, the words weren't chosen. Sorry.
The words were chosen by the researchers. I mean, there was a large project in the run-up to this project
in choosing
the right set of words out of a large number of possibilities. And
but
one thing is
choosing the word, they also define where the words are on the chip, right?
The words are just dimensions. So what I'm drawing here is something that exists in 147 dimensions.
Yes.
Right, so those are semantic dimensions. Mm-hmm.
Perhaps it's important to stress that no single word corresponds most of the time to a single odorant.
Yeah.
So an odorant will always be somewhere, not necessarily on one of the axes of
this. I see.
Question?
Yeah, so there are a number of very strong smells, like the smell of garlic or frying fish or a bakery shop, that I don't see where they fit on this potato chip at all. So,
I guess
I mean, garlic would be somewhere like closer to the unpleasant, to the pole of unpleasantness.
It depends on.
Right, but if you average over many people, it will be somewhere.
But how can one judge in the audience that garlic is not on this multi-dimensional space if we only see six?
From this.
Garlic might be one of the dimensions for all of that matters.
I don't remember. And I mean, I don't think the garlic
and
was
if
on.
Not, it's a good combination of a couple of them.
I should also stress that those were single molecules, like most of the database is just single molecules, so they really smell ambiguous. I mean,
50% of the variance.
Huh?
Keep in mind, there's also 50% of the variance.
There's also quite a bit of variance. Talking about variance.
Yeah. I have a question about the topology of the space. So it has a boundary.
Yeah.
And in vision, the boundary of color space is either the pure spectral colors or the line of purples. There's a very specific meaning to the boundary. It's not even obvious to me that the space of smells should even be a space with a boundary. And is it clear? Is it a sharp boundary? Is that an aspect that's been really verified in the data?
I can't say. One thing which I can tell you is that if you look at the distribution of smells on the surface, so this is the pole of pleasantness, right? So there are molecules that are basically clinging to this pole, and it's very difficult to produce. I mean, the molecules that they include, they were relevant to perfume industry. So it's apparently very difficult to produce extremely pleasant smell. So the focusing of the molecules at the pole of pleasant, there is some also accumulation at the pole of unpleasantness. And here there is a the density is lower. So it's probably that there are some physical limitations on how pleasant the molecule can be. And the, you know, perfumers or chemists, they're attempting to create the most pleasant molecule, but it's difficult. And that creates the boundary. That would be my guess. Let me talk about higher dimensions.
It depends on the intensity, because you know, I don't know which way they are, you know, people are, you know, feeling these smells. But you know, you can increase the smell by, you know, by having it. So does it influence to this paper? You know, the way it goes.
The database actually includes several smells that are at two different intensities, uh-huh. and they map to very close points.
Uh-huh.
So which means that the, at least within the range of intensities that they considered, it's the identity, the perception of other identities invariant with respect uh-huh. to concentrations or intensity. But there are indeed like changes that occur. In fact, last week we were discussing the smell of vinegar, which at low concentration may be pleasant to a fruit fly, but then at high concentration becomes repulsive to mm-hmm. the fruit fly. So there may be changes in odor identity as you change concentration. Question? Yep.
So you have several words that really are connected to substances like fruity. So you could test what kind of molecules just are emitted by fruits, for example.
Yeah.
Would these molecules then, if you get them isolated, would they remind me of a fruit, or could they smell completely different, or like?
I'm guessing that some of them will, but I'm guessing that most of them will not.
The answer is that most of them will.
Will?
Yeah. Okay. But most of these small molecules emitted by fruits have this fruity smell.
I mean, it strikes me that for the other four senses, you wouldn't even have to do this exercise because we just have words to describe all the different colors, all the different sounds, all the different ways of touching someone, temperatures, salty, not salt. So what is it about? Why do we have such trouble? Why don't we have words for smells? Why do we have such a poverty of language when it comes to smells compared to everything else we do?
Maybe because we're monkeys and like we're basically visual animals. We are focused on vision and well, sort of something that we can relate to. But, you know, olfaction is not something that, you know, nowadays we don't even pay attention to. So not much. You know. So it's difficult. It's very counterintuitive for us. The classification of smells is very counterintuitive.
So you mean that dogs would be able to speak? They would have
those. Indeed, yes. In fact, the problem is to make a speaking mouse so that it can.
Yeah.
You can tell us. You can speaking mouse that would be able to tell us the person. Well, we don't have to stick with two dimensions. We can go to higher dimensions, and I'm going to draw here percent variance. Variance capture. As a function of number of dimensions. Number of parameters that describe a point on the manifold. And so this would be zero dimension at zero, and then at 1, 2, 2 is the something that I described, and it's close to 50%. Then we can also go to the three-dimensional, so the two-dimensional potato chip describes about 50%, and then the three-dimensional potato chip,
which we call potato.
Well, basically on the line, so. And then by about six dimensions, the variance captured actually saturates at a value of about 80%. And one can also estimate the amount of remaining variance, the statistical variance with 150 people. It's probably about 7%. So this would be 80%. So basically the idea is that this data set is close to six-dimensional. So with six dimensions, you already describe almost everything that is there.
Is that called a hyperspud?
You described this data, but it seems to me that obtaining more of this data is trivial. So is there a reason why?
It's 150 people.
I understand, but today it seems, is there a reason this individual, made this way to do it, but it just seems, the whole industry, depending on 150 samples, just seems crazy. 150 people.
150
people. 150 people. Did you take part in this?
No, it's just a coincidence. The dimensionality and the number of people.
No, I understand. I'm just saying.
Unfortunately, the numbers are close to 150.
We can argue here. Right. Yeah, if it's a serious, people should get more.
Serious,
data.
Yeah.
And there's cultures that have different.
Yeah, okay, go ahead.
I think most people are just not serious about it. I think that's
okay, got it. Okay.
So the database also has mixtures, and mixtures, the curve for mixtures, it looks like this. It's basically shifted by one dimension, but then at about six dimensions, they collapse, two curves collapse.
What's
so it looks like at the low level of variance, mixtures have an extra dimension. And in fact, you can classify smells, whether they are mixtures or not, on the basis of those vectors, with some degree of. So you can actually figure out what this extra dimension is, which is added by the mixtures, and which could also be called the third mixture or complexity dimension. So let me stop here about on describing the percepts. I will shift to the neural representations. So how does this all come about? And I want to be sure that you understand that I'm not going to really tell you how it happened. Not today.
Can I just ask one more question about perception? So also in color vision, strategy for determining what the average eye is to ask people what colors they can distinguish. In fact, there's a way to protocol for doing that. So I would imagine one would have tried the same thing with smells.
Yes,
maybe
it's a very
too
good question.
Easy for single
model. Excellent question. Those attempts actually failed. So what they produce, if you ask two people to compare smells, well, you need to then average, you need to get some statistics over people. And no people can agree the parameters how to compare smells. So what you get as a result, you get a one-dimensional data set. And guess what this one dimension is? Can you guess?
Yeah, it's a vertical one.
It's a vertical dimension, exactly. So what you get, instead of the potato chip, you get a sausage. It's a burnt sausage, but so there's a data set like that. But the idea is that the only thing that people can agree on, approximately, is how pleasant the smells are. But they can't really agree on a lot of attributes, and they just average out in the pairwise comparison matters.
But I think he was asking about distinguishability of two nearby smells, two nearby odorants somehow.
Right.
So even a,
what was the question?
Being able to differentiate two odorants from one another.
Yes, you can't tell the
difference. That are similar.
You can tell the difference between the smells, yes, that's true. And in fact, this distinguishability, it is proportional to the distance in this 147-dimensional space. So you can relate how similar the smells are by judged by people to how far they are in this space.
Isn't the problem here that we always get smells in combination? So all our names for these things, you know, garlic is some combination and so on. I think what you should really do is train people to associate words with the primary smells and then see how much they can discriminate using.
There aren't any primary smells.
No, I'm talking about something that takes out of the equation the association and all the mental activity of associating words. It's just, can you distinguish? So suppose you expose somebody to a smell, and then later you say, you get a reward if you can tell me which one of these is the same one as the one I showed you before.
Right.
And then it's nothing about words, and it's nothing about thoughts.
Right.
It's just, can you do it?
People can tell the difference between any pair of those two smells. So there's no information there.
They're fully distinguishable.
Yeah.
That's for the pure, the single molecule ones. Maybe for mixtures, it's more interesting.
Maybe.
I think we are mixing again the words that appear here with molecules. I think these questions that you asked are very well taken. If you do just pairwise comparisons of molecules, and you ask people just to say are they different or not, the numbers that roam around the literature are that people can actually distinguish pairwise as many as 10,000 smells, odorants. If you ask them to describe, it's a different story. If you ask them to give multiple descriptions so as to put it on the potato, that's a different story. But clearly, people can distinguish many more than 147 smells. There is absolutely no question about that.
Right. But you can also distinguish many colors, but you still have a two-dimensional color space.
But this irregular axis, maybe, I don't know, there are actually recent papers that are discussed, maybe you should mention that Marcus's and like, the point is that you don't know how to order these orders in some rational axis. In color, it's fine, you can do two pairs, you know how to put the distance between two wavelengths, or how do you take two molecules, where do you put it, how do you...
No, but two spectra are two points in a very, very high dimensional space.
All right, we're going to let you move on, Alexa.
All right.
Question. David's got a question.
But if you have in mind something like analog of RGB, then it should be a possibility to consider mixtures or whatever, because, you know, if you have some primary elements, you said that there is no primary elements, right? No. So then it's against RGB.
Also, RGB is not really primary. It's a decision that was made arbitrarily. But anyway, you can use, this is a kind of RGB, and if you use that, you can distinguish and put on space a lot of different odorants by asking people.
It looks like Alexei has triggered neural processing in the crowd.
So yes, that's good.
So neural processing. I'll just describe the... Perhaps I'll have enough time to describe what receptors are and how they represent smells. So so we have the surface of the nose, nasal cavity. Then on the surface of the nose, so this is olfactory epithelium, there are cells, neurons, like this, that have some resemblance of hands sticking out into the epithelium. So there are a lot of those cells, several million.
And if I take this hand called the psyllium and I blow it out, so this would be the membrane of the cell. On the surface of the membrane, there are proteins, molecules, that are called odorant receptors. I'll draw them as boxes, but they're actually very complex looking molecules. Molecules have tiny slots of different shapes in them. There are about 1,000 in mouse genome, there are about 1,000 types of these molecules. So the key thing here is that every cell, every one of those cells, selects only one molecule to produce. Let's say R11. This will be the 11th receptor. So all the receptors that are produced by this cell will be of the same type. And the molecules that float in the air, in the nasal cavity, if they can bind, if they have a matching slot on the receptor molecule, they can bind and activate the molecule. And as a result, the molecule will, of its activation, the molecule will convey the signal to the cell, and the cell will get activated. Well, there are another cell right here. Its psyllium will express on the surface of that cell, there will be a different type of receptor with a circular slot. And this circular, this other type of receptor, say R529, in the presence of this molecule in the air, the molecule will not bind, it will not activate this receptor. As a result, this cell will remain silent. So, and then the cells, once the receptor gets activated, they will start responding. And the response of neurons are the action potentials, so spikes, that are emitted by the cell, and they propagate down the output of the cell, or axon. And that's how the cells convey that they have been activated. So the pattern of activation of 1,000 receptors.
But it is just kind of a geometrical way of reacting to the odorant or amino. How these receptors are.
It's a somewhat controversial subject. So there are two theories. One of them is the steric theory, according to which there is a matching of shapes. Which I do here. Another one is that there is vibrations in the molecule. I mean, that's a minority theory,
very minority theory
that vibrations in the molecule are perceived. So receptors are actually spectroscopes that measure vibrational modes in the molecule.
So it's wrong to say that to physicists because they will follow this alien.
That's what I'm doing. So the pattern of activation of those molecules, of the types of receptors, and of course there are multiple receptor molecules in each cell, and there are multiple cells with the same receptor on the epithelium, and then they convey this spiking pattern in the brain.
But a given neuron would have how many of these receptors? I mean, 1,000 each, or
a few thousand?
2,000.
I'm guessing.
Millions.
Millions?
So,
but for a given receptor, there must be a whole range of molecules that it's activated by, not just a single one.
That is true. So, for a typical range of concentrations, one molecule activates many types of receptors. And it's also mostly true that the bigger the concentration, the stronger the responses of the receptor neuron.
So basically, smells, you can think of smells as being represented in this thousand-dimensional vector. I'll call it Y. Basically, each entry, each component of this vector would be activity of individual receptor, type of receptor neuron. So this would be one, Y1, and this would be Y1000.
So the typical mammal, this would be 350 for a human?
Human is 350, yes. N, which is about 1,000.
Is the distribution of receptors uniform, so all the roughly all occur in the same amount?
Even the distribution, whether
there are millions of neurons, right?
So I don't think it's conclusively known. I mean, people say that receptors go, basically there's a binary distribution. So if they either are expressed, if they're expressed, they're expressed at roughly the same amount in the cell, but I don't think there is, it's really well known. So you can think that it's roughly, if it's turned on, it's turned on to the same level, roughly. So essentially, every cell has to make a decision, a stochastic decision, whether what receptor it's going to express.
So it's a vector is also in binary units, or when you're feeding that?
No. Yeah. So that will depend on concentration of the smell and on the type of smell that you have. Question?
No, just to follow up to the question. So the number of cells which express the same receptor, that's distributed in an equal way among the
different number cells. Of cells. How many? What is the variance in the number of cells? I don't know what the standard deviation of the number
of cells. Is like R11 about the same as R529, or is it them like really? There's a lot of them, and then some that's just one.
I think it's roughly the same. I mean the targets of them, which are some places in the brain that receive the receptor, they have roughly the same size. Mm-hmm. So judging from that, I could say that it's roughly the same pool of neurons. there's not this dramatic difference in the number of receptor neurons. Okay, so we have this vector. What I guess I will try to do next in the next half an hour that I have, is I'll try to give you a derivation why you have 1,000 receptors. How about this?
So the neurons, the axons are going to the brain. Are they going to a particular part of the brain?
Yes.
And that's
narrow.
Is it some small region?
Yeah. Let me actually draw this. Just if you stop by on any of the talks and workshops, you will know what we're talking about. So there is an area in the brain which is called olfactory bulb. At the surface of which is covered with bubbles called glomeruli. Glomerulus is a sphere in Latin. So, and then the receptors that have a single neuron, they have a single type of receptor. So you have, this is receptor 529, and this is receptor 11, right? So there will be another receptor neuron that is R11 here, okay? And of course, there are many of them. So they will converge, the same receptors that produce the same, receptor neurons that produce the same receptor will converge to the same glomerulus. So those two will arrive to the same glomerulus. So the glomerulus essentially receives the same input. And this R529 receptor neural projected different glomerulus.
Is it known how they end up wired like that?
How they wired?
How they end up wired like that, developmentally?
No.
Not fully. I mean, it's a very interesting question, but it appears that in individual mice, if you look at individual mice, the locations of the glomeruli that receive this R11 receptor will be very stereotypical. They will be very close to each other. There's a little bit of jitter, but they will basically be at the same location.
Yep.
I just had a question on a previous statement. So you said the given odorant binds to many receptors.
Yes.
But that seems to imply there's an issue of concentration.
Right. So at low concentration, there is the first receptor. Obviously, as you increase the odorant concentration, there will be the first receptor will be activated by the money.
But even before you increase the concentration, just at the leading edge, walking into an odor plume, at the leading edge of the plume, there are actually a very small number of glomeruli that are excited because you're at high dilution.
Right.
And as you said, in the laboratory, we tend to put on a bolus of odorant.
Right.
But it's just used perceptually that just a very one or a small number of glomeruli are activated.
I should say this that a single odorant can activate multiple receptors. But of course, at a very small concentration, will activate only one.
Is there evidence whether or not that's used perceptually, that you walk into a plume? Is the fact that you have this great discriminability because you're only activating a small number of mitral cells?
Yes, I think there is evidence here. But, and not exactly in this setting, but I think there is evidence. I mean, our work for the glomeruli, for example, is focusing on that. So, how many receptors do you need to recognize another? I mean, it's an excellent question. I mean, I guess the idea is whether the first exposure to smell, first few milliseconds that you perceive a smell, whether how important they are with respect to the remainder of the activation path. And that's
Well, it's not just the first few milliseconds. It's just when you're at the sort of leading tail of
right.
The plume, when it comes to you.
So I want to basically give you a brief derivation of 1,000 receptors. So and I'll basically use the ideas from statistics that are existent within a field called compressed sensing. So I'll rely on that. So this is the why. This is a product of interaction of molecules with a bunch of odorant molecules with a bunch of receptors and receptor molecules. But what is the X? What is the input space? Well, most of the odorants that we encounter in nature are mixtures, right? So input is X, is a vector that contains various concentrations of various molecules. Most of them are zeros, right? A typical mixture would include 10 to 100 molecules. And there are probably roughly about 1 million possible molecules that you can be exposed to. So I'll call it N. So, I mean, there's a huge number of molecules that we can recognize. But the number of non-zero entries in this vector is small. It's about 100. I'll call it K. So these are the non-zero entries. The entries, non-zero entries will contain the concentrations of a particular molecule that is present in the environment. And the rest of them are zero. So it's a million-dimensional vector with K non-zero components. So K is about 100. It's basically a very sparse vector.
Yeah, that's just for a typical mixture that you would be encountering. There would be 100 different molecules. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. So now there is a combination. There is some formula that relates those three numbers, which I'll try to derive. Okay, So let's assume that we have a linear model for receptor. So
So y is a function of x. It's a matrix times x.
The matrix is basically, it represents affinities of receptor to a given molecule.
So it looks like this. So you have a small 1,000 dimensional y, and it's equal to a long matrix A multiplied by full vector x. And x is n-dimensional, it's just number of molecules. Y is n-dimensional, and the matrix of affinities is n by n-dimensional. So what I need to do is I need to...
What our factory system may attempt to do is to try to figure out what x is based on y. Right. Which is...
So the problem is, what is x?
And of course, it's extremely underdetermined, right? Because you have million
unknowns, and you have only 1,000 knowns.
But still, it turns out that you can solve it.
And that is because this number of non-zero components is very small. To basically see why you can solve it,
we can just compare
the number of the entropy in X and an entropy in Y.
Right.
So, or the number of combinations. Because so we find A, we can find X. I'm asking, what does it mean? So find A?
No, assume that I know A.
Oh, you know A?
I know A. Okay. So,
can I find
X if I know Y?
And A.
Does it make sense?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is actually, I'm arguing that this is what olfactory system is doing in the olfactory ball, actually. So I don't have time to talk in detail about it, but if you ask me later, I can tell you offline.
So I just need to compare entropies on X and Y. So, well, entropy is logarithmic number of combinations. So I can just compare number of combinations. Number of combinations in Y, I will assume that Ys are basically binary. Zero, for simplicity. I mean, it's a back of the envelope estimation. So the number of combinations in Y is roughly 2 to the power n. So if each component in Y can have, or just number of possible values of Y. And this has to be roughly, for the system to be solvable, this has to be roughly equal to the number of combinations in X. The number of combinations of X is the sparse vector with k components. Well, it's a binomial coefficient for a small number of components. I can just say that this is roughly m to the power k.
Right.
So, I mean, there is a binomial coefficient, but for a small number of k's, I can use just a steering point or something like that. Mm-hmm. So, if I compute logarithm, I will see that n is roughly, is approximately equal to k log n.
So that's the formula that relates those three numbers. And let's see if it works.
So this is roughly 100 times logarithm of 10 to the 6, which is 6 times 100 times logarithm of 10, which is roughly 2. Mm-hmm. So it's about 1,200. So it works pretty well. How can I solve it? So there is a compressed sensing field, which describes algorithms, how I can solve this problem with sparse, where I can find a sparse vector. Mm-hmm. And the idea I'll express on the phase diagram, which is called Donohoe-Tanner phase diagram. So it has those two numbers,
would be n over m on the vertical. And on the horizontal, it has k over m. And so there's from 0 to 1. Which of those? And it's a logarithm independence. It's basically x logarithm x. So that's the curve which I described here. This would be something like m over m equals to k over m log m over k. My point is that our factory system is right on the edge, and this is called Donohoe-Tanner phase transition.
Well, actually, where did 10 to the 6 come from again? Where did the number come from?
Where did the number come from?
Yeah, really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a PubChem database that contains 10 million. Actually, it contains 50 million chemicals. And just my rough estimate of how many molecules there are that have molecular mass below 300. That's my just rough estimate. But as you can see, this number is in the logarithm, so it doesn't really matter. Right, so if I'm wrong by 2 orders of magnitude, it'll just change the answer by 30%. I'm giving an estimate. It's not a precise answer.
What about the trillion order idea?
Trillion? Those are trillion mixtures. Mixtures, of course. I mean, this vector is huge. Right. So there's a huge number of mixtures that you can generate. I'm talking about single molecules. Right. So each component in this vector is a single molecule. So this is Donohoe-Tanner phase transition. So turns out that here you can actually solve, in this area, you can solve the problem by finding x as a minimum of the norm of x. Under the condition that we have y equals to ax. So in this area, above when the number of components on y is above this criterion, you can actually solve the problem by solving this problem. And you will be able to recover x from a very small number of components y, which is the meaning of compression in compressive, or compression in compressed sense. So I guess I'm...
I stand next to the nasal cavity,
I'm going to stop here. And, thank you for your attention.
We have some minutes for more questions. Yeah.
This reminds me of something that I was reading about and understanding just as vaguely as I understood this, namely the immune system, where the problem is there are cells in the body that learn to recognize self and non-self and then act accordingly. Is there any evolutionary relation between the olfactory system and the immune system, or are there similarities in the research techniques that one needs to sort of start disentangling these things?
I'm not aware of any similarity. I mean, there are a lot of people who study the immune system and then to olfaction. And I mean, maybe somebody else from the workshop has any ideas about similarity. There is a coupling between the major histocompatibility complex and olfaction, though. Like, major histocompatibility complex is a set of genes that produce antigens for T cells. And they're actually, those molecules are related somehow to individual smells of people. So there's basically, it looks like our olfactory system actually is capable of recognizing the immune system, not how similar or different they are.
I think there is an analogy to be made. So even though they may have evolved differently, in both cases, you have a smaller repertoire of receptors that must somehow commit to recognize much larger space of things. Yeah. And you can, for example, ask the question, if you can reorganize the receptors in some way, what is the, given your finite repertoire, what is the best organization of those receptors to, I don't know, minimize time to recognition or something in the immune system? Not exactly an analogy with the kind of question you ask here, but related, because, you know, you have a smaller repertoire of receptors. There's a paper on that actually by myself and Thierry Mora and Alexander Balchek from PNAS this year. And you get some interesting results about the organization of the immune repertoire. So, and that's actually basically inspired by working olfactionally.
What's your question? What's your lesson? Vijay Balasubramanian. Okay. Yes. Just wondering, is there, maybe they don't have enough data yet, but is there any knowledge about sort of the like underlying neural circuitry, I guess in a stage beyond the olfactory bulb that might be performing this kind of mathematical operation you're outlining?
I think olfactory bulb actually makes, performs this calculation because like you can see just from the basic anatomy. So the olfactory bulb is actually filled with cells, which are called granule cells. And there are about 10, there's about a million of them, maybe 4 million in rat. And that matches very nicely with the number of molecules. So the potential molecules in the universe. So I mean, I'm proposing that those granule cells are the ones that perform this calculation. And you can actually find the circuit basis for that as well. Question?
Are there any olfactory synthetes? Or people that say hear a tone and smell something? As is the case with vision. Vision is very well studied.
I'm not aware of that. I mean, you mean...
Maybe it doesn't exist. Right?
By synesthesia, you mean? You mean just people who display synesthesia?
They hear a tone, say, and then they have an impression of a color.
Yeah.
Like Olivier Messiaen is a composer. Is a synthete. Okay.
I have a question about the cells, well, the axons that connect the nasal cavity to the olfactory bulb. I remember learning at one point that those are constantly refreshed, replenished, regrown on a pretty rapid rate.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering what's known physically about the spatial arrangement of that regrowth process. Like, does something start at the nasal cavity and have to find its way to the correct glomuli or whatever it is? Or does it all form, like, non-locally? I mean, how are they replaced?
They all have to grow and connect.
Pardon?
To regrow and connect.
So, yes. But do they regrow from a starting, from one end and go the other way? I mean,
the cells that make those cells, they're located in the epithelium.
In the
epithelium, they're located here. Well, I mean, there are stem cells that generate those neurons, and then they have to grow.
So they have to find their way to the right
place
in the olfactory bulb.
There's another interesting thing is that these granule cells are actually, it's one of the parts in the brain that constantly generates new neurons. So the granule cells are constantly produced somewhere in the middle of the brain, and then they crawl, and they arrive to the olfactory bulb, and then they connect to glomeruli. So this is one of those two places in the brain where new neurons are produced in brain.
Embryos or old people?
Adults.
Huh? In embryos or old people?
In adult people.
What's the time scale? Yeah, what's the time scale? Like in months?
Like every day or every week?
I don't know. I mean, there are some papers that claim that it doesn't happen in people, but I think the evidence there. I mean, there was a paper published a few years ago that says that it happens everywhere in other animals, but not in people. But I think the evidence is there not really convincing. So there's a hippocampus where cells constantly are turned over, and olfactory bulb is another example. The granule cells.
I know there are more questions, but we have to stop. So, how long are you here?
We're here for 2 months.
So 2 months.
Please visit, stop by, and sit in the lecture center. It will make sense.
Thank you.